Welcome to Creating a Family, Talk About Infertility. Do us a favor, please let your friends know about this podcast. Most people find out about podcasting from their friends, so be a friend, both to your friends and to us, and we really would appreciate it. Today, we're going to be talking about living with infertility with Andrea Sertesh. She struggled with infertility since 2012 and recently became a mom through surrogacy. She is a relationship expert and coach and a TV personality, and she is the author of He's Just Not Your Type, and That's a Good Thing, and Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband. Through her infertility struggles, she realized the need for information and support for the infertility struggles, and she founded Pregnant-ish. It is an online lifestyle magazine dedicated to helping singles, couples, and the LGBTQ community navigate the whole infertility journey. Welcome, Andrea, to Creating a Family. I'm so looking forward to hearing about your journey.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's great to be on.
Excellent. And by the way, congratulations. I know you are a relatively new mom. How old is your daughter?
She's 10 months, but I joke that she's also 3 years old because we created the embryo before we worked with my cousin, who's a gestational carrier. Mm-hmm. We created the embryo in 2016. So I say she's 10 months and also 3 years old.
The real question,
how you look at it.
Okay, but three-year-olds can be a little bossy. So let me ask, what is her personality? Is she act like a three-year-old or act like a 10-month-old?
Well, I call her a teenager, actually, because she's learned how to say no already as a baby. So she has a little bit of attitude with that, but she's generally the happiest baby. She makes me the happiest person, so I can't complain.
Wonderful. All right. So let's start by talking. You've alluded to how your journey, I won't say ended because we're going to talk about that later on in the interview, but let's start at the beginning. You first started trying in 2012, if I understand it.
Well, ish. I mean, we started trying a year or two before that, on our own. When I married my husband, I told him it may take us a couple of years to have a baby because I had remembered when I was 14, an OBGYN told me I had probably had endometriosis, put me on the birth control pill and said, you may have fertility issues later. And that was when I was 14. The last thing on my mind was getting pregnant.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't sexually active. It was very, I was a kid. I wasn't thinking of having a kid. So I just kind of put it out of my mind. And then when I got married, I told my husband, may take us a couple years. So we first went to a reproductive endocrinologist, a specialist in 2012, but we had tried before then.
Okay. And, honestly, I begin the journey when I think of it, when you're first actively trying, most people try ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, recommends that if you're under 35, you try for a year. And that's, and when we use the word try, really that means with timed intercourse. So that's knowing your ovulation. Mm-hmm. So, a lot of people just stop using birth control and are not really timing and not really checking. They're just kind of enjoying the process. But I really start the timeline in my mind when you're tracking your ovulation and actively making sure you have sex during that time.
I agree. That's actively trying. And I don't think we were that even in the first year. So maybe we started even 3 years before that because we were what I call trying, not trying. If it happens, great. We're young. What's interesting is I thought it would take us a couple years. So I wasn't putting any pressure on us. It was kind of like, we'll see, we'll see when it happens. You start getting worried when you're trying, not trying, or not. And when you're tracking your ovulation, like you said, after I'd say way before a year hits, after 6 months, you start to wonder what's up because it can start to worry you that you thought it would happen faster or easier.
Exactly. When you start, the way the process often goes is you think, okay, we'll just ditch the birth control. We'll just see what happens. But after a couple of months, you start going, maybe I should read up on cervical mucus. Or that's even if you don't want to actively start buying the ovulation kits or taking your basal body temperature. But a lot of times you just are starting to notice and make sure that you're, getting together on those times. And so that's, and then you go, that doesn't work. And you think, okay, I need to actively start timing it. But that's the point where every month you're disappointed. You know, before then you can kind of say, well, you know, we're still just kind of trying, not trying.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And I think the average person, I mean, I'm a journalist. I interview a lot of people, and I've learned that a lot of people don't even realize that there's about a 48-hour window during which time you can get pregnant during ovulation. So there's a lot of also, I think, misunderstanding before you are actively trying to conceive that you don't even understand what it takes to try to create a baby.
No, you've been focused on not creating a baby.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly.
And in our minds, and quite frankly, what our parents and our teachers and others have told us is that, you know, you look at a boy wrong, you know, you're going to get pregnant. So keep your knees together or whatever. Our parents, even if our parents weren't quite that prudish.
Yeah, but we had a lot of warnings. It's true.
We did. And so, I mean, I certainly know that I thought that I could get pregnant really easy. And because that's, you know, I was actively not wanting that. So anyway.
Yeah.
So in 2012, you see a reproductive endocrinologist. Did you ever get a diagnosis? Was it endometriosis?
Well, so I think actually I first saw the OB and talked about my fertility kind of more deeply in 2011. And then eventually made my way to an RE's office. And during the first, you know, what they do when you go to a specialist, a reproductive specialist, is they do an ultrasound and some blood work. And that's when the RE said to me, wow, you have a massive fibroid tumor covering your tubes and ovaries. There's no physical way you could get pregnant with this. So of course you're not getting pregnant. So endo was on my brain, but it was in fact fibroid tumors preventing pregnancy from her perspective. Mm-hmm. So the next step there was, oh, well, that's why we're not getting pregnant. So let's remove this tumor. It was so large. One of the cruelest parts, I think, of the fibroid tumor diagnosis is that they measure it in terms of pregnancy. So they say to you, you're measuring 14 weeks pregnant with this fibroid. I think it's really cruel when you're going through infertility to be told that.
They also measure it by fruit sizes or vegetable sizes.
That I prefer at least.
Oh, no, see, I don't like that.
Well, all of it sucks, let's be honest.
Yeah. But I don't want to think of a cantaloupe.
That's true too. She did say something that was really, really insensitive. And I won't name names here of who said this to me. But she said, it's like two babies' heads are in you. How could you not know that this was in you? So she, three things happened there. I had shame from the doctor for not knowing it was in my body. Mm-hmm. I also had this image of babies in my body when I was heartbroken that at that point, a few years in, that I wasn't pregnant. And it was scary to think about how large this mass was in my body. And she said, you know, your next step is to have fibroid removal surgery, and it's going to be open stomach, myomectomy. It's really large. It's so large that they have to open you. They have to get in through surgery. And here's the good news. The good news, it's probably been growing for years, so there's no rush. So, great. But it will keep growing. Okay. So I was hosting a TV show at the time. As you said in the intro, I'm a TV personality, and I was hosting a show actually back in Toronto, where I'm originally from. I live in New York, but I was hosting this show for the Oprah Winfrey Network, and I was really busy. And I said, okay, you know, when we wrap production, I'm going to have this surgery and I'll be admitted. I heard, and it was true, for a number of days in the hospital.
Yeah. Open abdominal surgery is
big.
Pretty big.
And we prepared for it and we did it in the summer of 2012. And I remember clearly my OB saying, you know, you're going to need a few months before you start trying again. So everything in my mind was planned that we'd start formally trying again, maybe in early winter, because the surgery was in the summer, the production had wrapped. And it just felt like, okay, 2013 is our year to be pregnant. And that's when it's going to happen, because this is out of me. But that's not what happened. And we'll talk about that.
Okay. So you had the surgery. They removed the fibroids.
Yes.
Or fibroid. I guess you probably had more than one. And they, so was there scarring? Because that's one of the problems.
There was a little scarring. They told me that would probably happen. And my tube wasn't completely blocked, but there was some scarring. And my reproductive endocrinologist and my OB suggested we try IUI. but that the tube was more or less open and we still had one good tube and we should try IUI and see what.
Okay. So your next approach was an IUI, intrauterine insemination.
Yes. My first one was in early 2013. I think the first one didn't work. I think the second one didn't work, but they were really encouraged by my hormone levels. And so the third one worked and I got pregnant and we thought, okay, this is what we needed. So we're pregnant and we lost that pregnancy. I believe we were at about 9 or 10 weeks. We had seen a heartbeat, but still first trimester, but absolutely devastated when I lost that pregnancy in November 2013. And that set me back for a number of months. But because IUI had worked, I was encouraged, and our insurance covered IUI, and everybody who's gone through infertility or fertility treatments understands this part of the story. As a patient, you do fertility treatments that are kind of within reach. We had, under my husband, who's a teacher, under his insurance plan, we had kind of unlimited IUIs. So I did unlimited IUIs. I felt like it got me pregnant. I was encouraged. But in 2014, the RE said to me, I think it's time to move to IVF. And I was sick of IUIs. It just was draining. And I thought, you know what? Now it's going to work. So we did our first IVF in the summer of 2014.
Let me stop you here and ask. Yeah. All right. How old were you? We all know that age is one of the predominant factors when we talk about infertility. So just roughly, what age were you around this time?
I don't even know, to be honest. I mean, we got married. And I actually don't talk about my age a lot, just in general, because I think it distracts. Age is an issue. Mine was not an age issue. We started trying when I was 30, 31 years old.
Okay.
So, you know, for me, like I was doing treatments in my mid 30s, early 30s, but it wasn't so much an age factor. I mean, it becomes an age factor after 35, which, you know, of course.
It's not like immediately at 35, but we know that. Right. Fertility is on a timeline. So, but you were starting at a young enough age that your issues wasn't egg quality. You weren't even sure at this point. So you
we weren't sure, but we were encouraged that I always produced many eggs and the embryos always looked, according to Ari's, beautiful. And, you know, even after being 35, going through IVF, I was producing a lot of eggs. So it was a mystery for a while why I had repeated implantation failure or pregnancy loss, because during, I think, IVF number one or two, I got pregnant and also lost that pregnancy.
Also relatively early on, first trimester?
Yes. That one was earlier. That one happened, you know, probably at 5 or 6 weeks. No heartbeat was detected, but I really hit rock bottom at that point, because at that point, we had been trying for something like 4 years, and I just was exhausted and financially depleted. And because that was number one or two IVF, and I had these good looking blastocyst embryos, and we just were sure it was going to work.
You know, so, and that's a hard thing too. We were talking about hard when somebody tells you, oh my gosh, it's a beautiful blastocyst, which a blastocyst is usually a 5 day old embryo.
Yes.
And at that point, they can see a lot of the formation and they can, you know, they can grade it. And they tell you it looks beautiful, and then it doesn't work. And then in some ways, I mean, I guess it's better to at least have had the know you can make good-looking embryos. But then when it doesn't work, it's like a double-edged sword.
It really is. It's why I started, and I'm sure we'll talk about pregnant-ish after, but why I call it being pregnant-ish is because it's a mind trip when you're in the first stage of a literal pregnancy with a fully formed, you know, the egg and sperm have fertilized. It's created a good-looking embryo. You're implanted with this embryo. You're in the first stage of pregnancy. You're hormonal from treatments. You're told by your doctor not to drink, not to over, you know, you're in the first stage of pregnancy.
And you're feeling the symptoms of pregnancy.
And you're feeling the symptoms of pregnancy. So I think it's a state of being pregnant-ish when you have infertility, because it's precarious.
Yeah.
And you can be a little bit pregnant. Everyone who's gone through infertility knows that.
Although oftentimes you feel like you're 100% pregnant, because I think that people discount the loss because you say, well, you were only 6 weeks pregnant or you were only 8 weeks pregnant. That is just not true. Or it could be for some people, but for many, many people, it is simply not true. The pain, the expectation. I mean, in many ways, you've been, you know, building up the love for and the expectations for this child for 5 years at this point. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So you hit rock bottom. You lost another pregnancy, probably second IVF. Did you have any embryos frozen at this point?
No. And in fact, I was discouraged from doing that. And I was discouraged from genetically testing embryos. Because what happens when you're a patient, and you know this and your listeners know this, after a while of repeated failures or losses, you start going to Dr. Google, you start looking around. And I just knew, like, this doesn't make sense. My levels looked good according to my doctors. My embryos looked beautiful according to my doctors. What is going on? And I remember asking in 2014, at the end of 2014, I said to, again, an unnamed doctor, and by the way, I love so many reproductive doctors. They've helped so many millions of people. But in this case, I'm just mentioning two that I did not have a great experience with.
Yeah, and that's fair.
This doctor said to me, save your money, go to Hawaii. And I'll never forget that, because he felt that it's too expensive. You know, at the time, this was 2014, genetic testing was more expensive than it is today. It was $6,000, I'll never forget, to test whether it was one or eight embryos. It was $6,000. And he said, go to Hawaii. And I said to my husband, he's right, I'm too stressed. I need a break. And we didn't go to Hawaii, but I knew what he meant. But they always say it's, you know, you look at things in retrospect and you kick yourself. Like, genetic testing would have been a huge open clue for me if I had pursued that, because I just kept doing endless cycles without that and just failing and failing. And in 2015, at the end of 2015, now I'm on fertility treatment, probably 15 or something, 14. I don't even know. I lost count because I did seven IUIs and I did like four full IVFs, and I was doing just so many treatments. And then between IVF, I'd throw in another IUI. I mean, it was just nonstop hormones for years at this
point. Oh gosh.
Just terrible. And
yeah, I can't imagine.
It was just part of my everyday life that I was running back and forth to the doctor. And I joke, and my intro video for Pregnant is called I Faked It on National Television, because I was all over. I was hosting another TV show for Discovery in these years with fertility shots in my purse and on air, and just like kind of not closeted with my friends, but people did not know what was happening behind the scenes, which is just common for anyone going through this. You're just balancing so much. And I was running back and forth to the doctor. And finally, in 2015, at the end of 2015, a doctor who had transferred, a different doctor in Canada who I really like, we went back to Canada for one cycle. In summer of 2015, he said to me, if this embryo doesn't work, he told me this in September 2015, we need you to genetically test, because this blastocyst looks wonderful. It's very high grade. It should work. And I even took a 14-hour or 12 to 14-hour train ride home to New York, or bus ride home to New York, because I was convinced that I caused my other pregnancy losses by flying. Uh-huh. So I took this long ride back. You know, I don't even eat meat. I ate red meat. I did everything that I read, every old tale that I read to keep the embryo in there. And I got the results back in December. We had done a frozen transfer. He said, let's do a frozen. Let's let your body relax. So we tried new things. December 2015, I got the call that it didn't work. And that's when my doctor said to me on the phone, I cannot do another transfer with you unless you do genetic testing, because I want to know what's happening. I don't know if it's your uterine environment, because we know I still probably had some endo. We didn't cut me open to determine it, but when we had my fibroid surgery, they found a little bit of that. We knew I had fibroid tumors still. We knew I had high natural killer cells, which may or may not impact implantation. That, you know, the jury's out on that. But
yeah, the jury's
out. The point is, I had, yeah, and I just had enough things, and he felt the missing piece was genetic testing, because we wanted to know if my eggs were okay. Mm-hmm. And so in 2016, we did more rounds of egg retrievals to try to genetically test embryos. So between 2016 and 2017, I did another, I don't know, three or four IVF retrievals, but I didn't do transfers. We created embryos. I don't even remember, honestly, Dawn, how many, because it's all a blur, because when you go through almost a decade of this, everything, I don't know in the timeline where things, but there are certain moments that are punctuated. I know what holiday it was when I was, experiencing a miscarriage, for instance. But so we genetically tested the embryos now in 2017. Mm-hmm. I think it was January 2017 or the end of 2016. And we had a couple healthy embryos. And
Wait, let me stop you here and let me ask a question. All right, so you had a number of embryos. You had gone through a couple, at least more than two IVF cycles. You produce good eggs, so you had quite a few embryos. You genetically tested and all of them. And of the ones you genetically tested, only a few were chromosomal?
Well, we tested, I think, six, and actually half were okay. So we didn't, like, what's strange about the story is one IVF retrieval was completely botched, and that was an issue at the clinic. I'm sorry for putting the clinic down, because there are a lot of great clinics, but I just had so many bumps along the way. Another one, I just had a very bad month, and we probably produced one embryo. You know, it wasn't always, it went back and forth. But for the most part, with, like, let's say I did three retrievals, we probably had two blasts from each, something like that. So of that, we had two healthy ones and one mosaic. And then we had three that were not deemed healthy.
Okay.
So my doctor felt encouraged by that, actually, and said, I think it's your body and not... Because keep in mind, we had tried for 6 years before that.
Sure.
When I was even younger. So anyway, the point is, he basically said, I think your best shot at meeting your baby is working with a gestational carrier. I had never heard of that term. I had heard of surrogacy. I didn't know, the nuances of surrogacy.
Yeah, well, exactly. Let me stop and remind everyone that this show is brought to you by the Ferring Pharmaceutical. They have been underwriting this show, and we are so appreciative of their underwriting support. And they want you to know about an app called Ferticom. It was designed by a reproductive psychologist, or actually two reproductive psychologists, and it is designed specifically to help women address the many challenging emotional life situations that arise while struggling to conceive. Andrea has been describing a lot of those challenging situations. The reality is, infertility is stressful, and learning how to cope with this stress or getting help coping with this stress is really helpful. And this app, Ferticom app, does just that. You can get more information about it at the website, Ferticom app, and that's APP at the end, .com. All right, we are talking with Andrea Sirtash about living with infertility. She is the founder of PregnantDish.com, and we're going to talk about more about PregnantDish in a minute. We left off, and Andrea has been going through heck and back, cleaning it up for the radio here. Making this a family show here, and has gone through more IVFs, or somewhere in the range of between IVFs and IUIs and everything else, 15 to 17. She has been basically on hormones, which is the part I cannot imagine, on hormones for close to 10 years. In other words, it has been a trial. Now, they have finally done the genetic testing, and they know they have two genetically normal embryos, but at this point, they're having to make the assumption that there is something with your body that is not allowing embryos to implant. By any chance at this point, I'm trying to remember, it's funny because when you're involved in this field, it's hard to remember, when developments come along and that you...
Oh, yeah.
So, because honestly, when you were first thinking about genetically testing, what I was thinking, and saying you wish you had, and I was thinking, the genetic tests have come along. The progress has just been really miraculous in the last 5 years. And this was before that. So who knows? But anyway, did they do any form? I don't remember when the endometrial receptivity tests started coming around.
That was a little later, I think. So now, genetic testing was offered to other patients I knew when I had asked my doctor in 2014 or 2015. It just was at a higher cost because you couldn't test each embryo. You had to send a batch.
There was also the problem of having to do it, get your test results back really quickly because yes. it's freezing and they still thought your better chances were with their fresh cycle.
Exactly. Yeah. So that anyway. All changed. And, you know, I think, again, my doctor was playing detective just by saying the fact that I had gone through 17 or 18 treatments mm-hmm. over 6 years at that point, or I think 5 years, 6 years, and we had tried naturally, and we'd had my fibroid removal, and I had good-looking embryos from his mm-hmm. vantage point. It all added up to him that something yeah. should have worked by now.
And you know, and that's common sense in a way, and mm-hmm. I'm always appreciative when doctors will say, okay, we can keep running tests, but the reality is, you know, something should have clicked, and it hasn't. So the only thing that's left, the only variable that we can control right now is the vessel, so to speak. So he suggests surrogacy. In your mind, surrogacy was using, we were thinking what we now call traditional surrogacy, where the surrogate often just goes through an IUI with the male partner's sperm and her egg. And so she is conceiving, and I'm using air quotes, naturally, her egg. Yeah. His sperm. And so that's what you were thinking of. And what was suggested was a gestational surrogate. So tell us the distinction there.
Gestational surrogacy essentially means that the carrier, the surrogate, isn't using her own genetic material. It's not her egg in her body that's fertilized with the sperm. So the gestational carrier, I was told by my RE in Canada, meant that we would use our genetic embryo that had been PGTA, well, now it's called PGTA, it used to be called PGS tested, genetic tested. We would use that healthy embryo, put it in her body. If she had had successful live births, you know, healthy pregnancies, we'd have a 60 to 80% chance of meeting our baby that way. And he said, and that to me was like full record stop. Like I hadn't heard a statistic like that even through IVF. I was so dazzled that as sad as it was for me to let go of the idea of carrying my baby, that was undeniable, you know, a statistic that was comforting to me.
Oh, absolutely.
And so I said, okay, now I just need to find a gestational carrier, which I laugh at today because there's no just one. When it comes to any of these steps are long processes, but that was in early, I think that was late 20, again, I'm confused with timelines. I think it was either late 2016 after more retrievals or early 2017 after we got the test results of the genetic testing. Mm-hmm. And then we prepared applications for a surrogacy agency in Canada at the time, because that's where we were from originally, and it felt more within reach financially for us.
Is it less? I am not familiar with Canadian surrogacy laws. I'm assuming it's fully legal in all provinces. Mm-hmm. Okay,
It's fully legal. It's also there's a really good protection for both intended parents and surrogates, and it's altruistic, which is controversial. I mean, some people don't believe in altruistic surrogacy, whereby the carrier is not compensated for carrying. You still are covering all, you know, expenses that relate to the pregnancy, the medical expenses. You're covering babysitting or cleaning or daycare or any needs that the carrier has, but you're not actually paying for her uterus usage.
Yeah. To say it plainly. Well, that would save considerable money.
Yes, that does. And it saves on average. I mean, I'm not speaking with any exact price here, but I was told that it would save on average about $50,000.
That would make sense. That would actually make sense. That would make that much or less. You may not know the answer to this. I'm just curious. Mm-hmm. Do you have to be a Canadian citizen in order to utilize a Canadian surrogate?
You do not. And they have a big medical tourism program, but it's probably easier if you're a Canadian citizen. There are more fees if you're not Canadian citizen. I still had some healthcare coverage. The basic structure of the Canadian system, because it's altruistic, there's also a downside to it, which is someone's volunteering, which is, I think all of surrogacy, it's just a beautiful thing for anyone to help people who need help to bring a baby into the world. But, you know, it's more even though there are legal contracts, and when you're volunteering, it's just going to be a little riskier because, and that's what we learned. So,
yeah, riskier, not, and let me make sure I'm clarifying, not riskier medically for or anything like that. Riskier in the sense that if, I think if I'm understanding you correctly, what you're saying is that it would be if the surrogate is not being compensated for the 9 months that she is carrying a baby, it is easier for her to back out, I think, is if I'm understanding what you're saying.
Absolutely. That is what I'm saying. And I learned that the hard way. I know a lot, by the way, there are plenty of people who work with gestational surrogates and traditional surrogates in Canada and have good experiences. We did not. We worked with two who dropped out on us. So between 2017 and 2018, I put in my application in 2017. It took months to match with one. And they pick, you know, the carrier in this case picks the couple. And the first one lived in the west coast of Canada and picked us. She had just carried for a gay couple a few months prior to that. And her husband felt very uncomfortable with her entering a new agreement so soon. And I understand that.
Yeah.
So she dropped out relatively fast. It was the second one that we were matched with. Again, months go by. Nothing is fast in this world. So everything takes months of paperwork and testing and matching. The second one we met in August 2017, I'll never forget our Skype with her. And I thought this was meant to be. She said everything right. She told us she picked us because we had gone through such a hard time and she really wanted to help. And I believe in her heart that was real, but she ghosted us in December of 2017. And I never spoke to her again after we had paid for all the medical testing, all the legal negotiations, all the counseling that is required in surrogacy agreements. We'd gone through months between September and December of that. I had been sending her child gifts. We had written letters and we said yes to literally everything she asked for in the legal contract because we were so grateful to her that we weren't going to say no to anything. And she just disappeared. And the agency we worked with weren't upfront about it either. And in January, I'll never forget, January 6, 2018, I got the email that was just sent me reeling, which basically said, plans have changed. We lost over $10,000. And it was not the money. It was one thing for my body to fail me or for infertility to just constantly let me down. But human error, human indecision, or it just felt so cruel. And I always try to be compassionate and consider someone else's perspective. But the way it was handled was also really upsetting. We just never got an answer personally. But around this time in mid-January, my mother-in-law was going through chemotherapy. We were just juggling a lot. And my husband and I just felt hopeless, completely hopeless. We were financially depleted, emotionally depleted. And my cousin, my first cousin, Alana, her husband emailed me, Happy New Year. How are you doing? And you're supposed to just say, great, Happy New Year. And that's not what it
said. He was really, there was a correct response. And that was fine. How about you?
Yeah, exactly. I think he thought it would be a quick conversation. And I just said, no, I'm it was over Facebook. I said, I'm doing terribly. How are you? My surrogate, my cousin knew we were working with this woman. So she knew that story. I said, she just dropped out on us and we can't see straight. And the next day, my cousin, he told his wife, my cousin Alana, she's my first cousin, and he texted her. I mean, she texted me and she said, have you ever thought of a family member to help? I want to carry your baby.
Oh, wow.
I was shaking when I tell you, like, the phone probably dropped. I was shaking so much and crying so much that I couldn't even call her. She said, call me. I said, I can't, I'm not speaking English right now. I just knew when I got that text that this was it. I knew it was it because first of all, I trust her deeply. She has two beautiful kids that she carried, had healthy pregnancies. She and I have always been connected and close. And I just felt like this was the answer. She said, let's do this. And that's how I have a 10-month-old baby today. She was, the transfer happened. This is a bizarre fact. The same day that my egg was retrieved in April 2016, the transfer happened 2018. Yeah. And that's a coincidence, you could say in quotes, but who knows. And she delivered our baby in December of 2018. So,
wow.
Yeah, that was the embryo.
Yeah. People will often, when you, I think there are so many misconceptions in general about fertility, infertility, mm-hmm. but in specific right now, I'm talking about surrogacy. People will say, well, have you asked your sister? Have you asked your
yes.
And I'm thinking, that's not just a, hey, can I borrow a cup of sugar?
Exactly.
It's a big darn ask.
Huge ask. And it's so, one thing I always say is stop using the word just or should.
Yes,
when
exactly.
you give advice to people with infertility. Well, advice in general, but advice with infertility. The you should just is the worst combination of words, but we've all heard that. We've all heard that.
Oh, yeah. Just adopt is another one. Why don't you just adopt?
As if you go to the puppy pound. And
As if just can be used to describe a process such as adoption.
Exactly.
And then just, why don't you just ask your sister?
Oh, yeah. You should just ask your friend. Yeah, all of this is, I know people are well-intentioned, but I'm a relationships writer. So one of my big goals with Pregnantish has been to guide more of a conversation around how to balance relationships during this process.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, for sure. Let me pause briefly to remind people that this show is brought to you by the very generous support of our partners. And these are organizations, clinics who believe in our mission of providing unbiased, medically accurate information to the infertility community. One such partner is Cryos International Sperm and Egg Bank. They are dedicated to providing a wide selection of high quality, extensively screened frozen donor sperm and eggs. And they cover all races, ethnicities, and phenotypes. And they can provide you sperm for both home insemination as well as fertility treatment. Cryos International is the world's largest sperm bank and the first freestanding independent egg bank in the United States. We also are partnered with Reproductive Medicine Associates of New York. They are one of the largest fertility practices in the state and one of the biggest in the country. By combining the latest innovations in reproductive sciences with compassionate and customized treatment plans, RMA of New York is able to provide the very best possible care. All right, we are talking with Andrea Sertash about her long and rather arduous, I guess everybody's is pretty arduous, but yours does seem to really take the cake here, journey with infertility. So your cousin had two children of her own, and she was willing to carry a baby for you. And then relatively quickly, you did the transfer. I'm assuming you did a single embryo transfer?
We did. So because of the genetic testing, that was recommended to us and they knew it was healthy. So they transferred one in April 2018. Now, I should say she offered in January. It was a fast track because of who my cousin is and who I am. We're both real doers and go-getters. And so together we were on fire pushing through all the steps. And he said,
yeah, because that's pretty fast.
Pretty fast. She's modern Orthodox. I should mention she even consulted with a rabbi to make sure she could do this. I am not religious, but she comes from a more religious framework, and she didn't want to start her shots over Passover. She had all these kind of date restrictions with that, but otherwise she was really wide open. And she's one of these fertile people, and I always joke about this, but just every time they did ultrasounds, they'd say, oh, everything looks beautiful in your uterus. Like, I never got that. And she planned her pregnancies, her two kids. She wanted summer babies. She had summer babies. So she said to me, I'd like to deliver your baby between December and February. And that's exactly what happened.
Did you laugh when she said that?
I did. I said, ha, 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 Lana, you don't know all the hiccups in this process. With her, everything just happened seamlessly. We had the embryo. It worked on the first try. I mean, it was great.
And does she live near you or do you live different places?
Well, we were really lucky in that my Canadian cousin lives in New Jersey and I live in New York. We were also lucky that New Jersey has good surrogacy laws. New York, of course, is still in another era and does not. So that was lucky. And my cousin, is like a 45 to 60 minute car ride. I'm a New Yorker, so I don't have a car. but I would take, a lot of shared rides to see her, and I'd go to the major ultrasounds and big appointments, and we'd speak on the phone and we'd FaceTime, and she had a really great pregnancy. The hardest part for her, I think, was the first part of progesterone shots, because she had never done fertility treatments. So that was more challenging for her, she says, than the pregnancy itself.
It's interesting. Yeah, when she hadn't, for you, you're used to being a human pincushion, but she was not. Yeah. And so, so fortunately she had, and it sounds like a relatively easy pregnancy. And what were some of the emotions that you go through when someone else is carrying your baby? And this is somebody you trust completely, mm-hmm. which I can only imagine would make it easier. Mm-hmm. But I can also just imagine that there would just be a whole mixture of jealousy, quite frankly, our mm-hmm. nerves are. And if it's not a person that you know intimately, then you worry, did she have a half a glass of wine, or mm-hmm. did she sneak a cigarette, or whatever?
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some of it. It is complicated. It's because you have no control, and that's part of the issue. It drives you nuts.
Yeah, definitely. I think it was, the fact that I trust her is huge. I will say, it's literally true that it's an out of body experience to have your baby in a surrogate.
All right. But I'm bum. All right.
Yeah, exactly. By the way, I run Pregnantish. Clearly I like puns and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Wordplay. Yeah. But no, Elena, I was used to seeing her pregnant. The weirdest part for me was registering that it was my baby in her. I was like, oh, look great. This is awesome. But it was like hard for me to connect that it was my baby.
Yeah.
Whenever she'd send me great audio of like the heartbeat when I wasn't at an appointment sometimes. But that was interesting. And the other part I think that's challenging about it, but then I'll tell you what was wonderful about it. But what was also challenging about it was a lot of people were kind of treating it like, Not people who knew me. People who knew my story were so happy for me. But everyone was putting kind of weird guilt on me that I would tell.
Okay, I will say it. There is a misconception. There's kind of this, like, it's the easy way out. You just don't feel like mm-hmm. going through 9 months of being mm-hmm. fat and having mm-hmm. heartburn and having stretch marks. Right. And the problem is, even if they don't say it, because one would assume most people would have the good sense not to actually articulate that, but it's like a subtext.
Yeah, it is. It is. Even when I was tired, when she delivered 2 days in, I was pretty tired because I had a newborn. People would say, but how can you be tired? You didn't deliver. It's like, I'm also tired from the last 8 years of trying to have this baby.
Yeah. Well, but, and also the fact that I'm not sleeping. Okay, I'm just giving you a hint.
I have a baby,
Yeah.
So there's a lot of the strange things that dynamics that come into play with not caring, mm-hmm. even from outsiders' perspectives.
Yeah.
Lana was so socially and emotionally intelligent and well-adjusted. She always knew how to respond when people would say, how will you feel when the baby's taken from you? She'd say, no baby's being taken from me. I'm carrying my cousin's baby. Like, think of it like an organ donor. Mm-hmm. But that's how she saw it. And so she educated a lot of people through it. We did a lot of media. So I've been in the media for years. So, when my story became public, Good Morning America covered it for National Infertility Awareness Week. We were in Reader's Digest and People Magazine. I mean, it was all over the place last year mm-hmm. because it was such an epic story. But there was another deeper entry. And we only have so much time to go through content here. So the People article to find out the deeper layers with being my cousin of why this pregnancy was so special.
Yeah.
But I mean, the feeling, I will just tell you, is out of body, but also thank God this baby's not in my body because I would have lost it.
Well, yeah, you didn't have a good track record. And so in a way, I hope that you were able to say that I'm giving this child a gift to not be carrying it.
I did feel that. Mm-hmm. And I would have been so much more nervous with the embryo in my body than a carrier who's healthy carrying.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I want to talk about Pregnantish as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's pregnantish.com. Mm-hmm. And that's pregnant with ish on the end.
Yeah.
.com. So why did you start it?
So long story short, it was originally a book that, because I'm an author, I told my agent about it in 2013. I said, I want to write the book of the effects of infertility on relationships. It's under, that's a chapter.
That is a important book to write. I'm just going to say.
It is. It really is. And I'm writing it. I'm still writing the content all the time about that.
Excellent. Excellent.
So that was the idea. My agent said, we have interest. I lost a pregnancy. I said, I can't write it. The next year, the same thing happened. I can't write it. Eventually, in 2016, I thought I have to cover this topic. Mm-hmm. And I realized it's more than me. It's more than my voice. Mm-hmm. I wasn't at the time able to find a good content site that spoke to me. I mean, there were good blogs, but they were both mostly personal blogs about people's journeys. There were good medical sites. There was Resolve, the National Infertility Association, which does great work. But there wasn't, you know, I'm a content person. I come from lifestyle media. I didn't feel there was a lifestyle platform. This was, again, in 2016, that was exclusively dedicated to this topic. It was always a vertical in parenting magazines. So all the parenting magazines had an infertility section, but that's a terrible place to hang out when you're going through this. So we launched Pregnantish as the first non-medical, the first kind of lifestyle site in this category to help singles, couples, LGBT navigate getting pregnant with help. There were some sites dedicated to IVF only, but we were really content beyond IVF. I mean, it's just modern family building. Of course, this is your great podcast does this, but our show, our site became a media site. So not just articles, not just videos. We do live events. It's really a 360 site where we featured over 50 professional writers. It was really important to me to hire great writers, to hire a great editor, which we have. So all the content is curated and produced with the same, you know, the same process that I went through in the book world with real editing and
making it professional.
From
your, and this is a general question, but you can answer it fairly generally, but what would you say are the biggest misconceptions about, let me say, fertility and infertility? You have been in this world for a long time. And as we say, there are so many misconceptions. But
there are so many.
There are so many.
Yeah. Well, okay. You mentioned one. So I will say that the biggest misconception is around age, but not for the reason people think. I think on both ends, age is a big misconception. Age is a misconception in that when Halle Berry's on the cover of a magazine at 48 or 50 pregnant, people think, oh, that could be me. Like, we don't know the backstory of how that happened with all the celebrities over 45 sporting baby bumps. Like, statistically, it's unlikely they, if they didn't freeze their own eggs, it's unlikely they use their own eggs. But that is confusing to our readers because at 46, 47, they're trying to do that. And I think the media doesn't always help when we put celebrities on the cover and don't tell the whole story. So age is a misconception on that end, but it's also the misconception on the other end that it's always an age issue. We just did a national survey of our audience. The average age was 33 of people who are reading our content, 33. And that's around, you know, that was around when we were trying. So I think age just all around is misunderstood when it comes to infertility.
And I would agree 100% with what you're saying. It cuts both ways. And in particular, it makes that women who are younger, you know, who are under 35, feel so alone. Like, okay, why is this? I mean, this is supposed to be, and it also adds, this is supposed to be happening to women who are older. But it also adds kind of a layer of shame or guilt for women who are 35 to 43 or 44 who, you know, that, well, you brought this on yourself. You were the one who made the choice. So it cuts, it hurts that way as well.
It does.
Okay. So that's, do you have another misconception?
Yes. I'll give you two quick ones. So one is that it's a rich white woman's issue. I mean, we know that over 30% is male factor. We know that it affects African-American women in high numbers, you know, like all of these, that is the story of infertility we see too much. And again, on Pregnantish, we have diverse voices. We've written about trans infertility. We've written about Black women in infertility. We've had a lot of wonderful African-American voices, Indian, Asian. We just have to talk about the diversity, the number of people it affects. It's a disease defined by the CDC as a disease. The last thing I'll say as a misconception is that it is a disease. That, listen, I launched a lifestyle site to talk about this disease, but traditionally it's been considered a lifestyle issue that's been served with medical resources. I've kind of flipped the script and said, well, it's actually a medical issue that needs more lifestyle support.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. So now you're in a weird position, potentially. You are in the infertility world, both as a professional now, and you certainly have spent many, many, many years of your life, your formative years of your life, struggling with infertility, but you're also a mom. And so we talk with people who are kind of betwixt and between, you know, they don't know where they belong. Has that been your experience, or are you, that doesn't affect everyone. So what's mm-hmm. your experience on that?
Well, I just had an interview the other day where someone said, how does it feel to be on the other side? And I corrected her and I said, well, I know what you mean, but I don't think I'm on the other side. I still very much am infertile. I have another healthy embryo maybe I'd love to meet, and I can't probably use my body. I'm probably having a hysterectomy, so I definitely can't use my body. And so, yeah, what does it mean to be on the other side? What does it feel like to be a mom in this community? It's very complex because there's obviously like survivor guilt, they call it. But I will say because I went through about 18 treatments, it took me 8 years to meet the baby. That helps strangely mm-hmm. because yeah. I think our audience knows.
Yeah.
Like I really get it.
You paid your dues.
I paid some dues. And I also really will never shake that off. I mean, that's just punctuated my marriage. It's been part of my adult life. Like, so I think if you go through a year, it's still very painful, but you might be able to kind of move on. I've heard people say, oh, once you have your kids, you don't think about it anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's true for a number of us.
Mm-hmm. And people say that with adoption as well. Well, once you adopt, you won't. And then that puts pressure and makes you feel like, if I feel any grief or if I get a baby announcement and it makes me sad, then I'm somehow betraying the love I feel for my child. Or in your case, it would be less the love you feel for your child, but more, you know, I'm stuck in the past. But I don't think you can go through a life-altering event, and you certainly went through a very long life-altering event, and not have it impact you.
I absolutely agree. And I always say to people in my relationship advice, the wonderful part of being human is that it can hold two emotions
Absolutely.
That seemingly conflict.
Yeah.
Happy for a friend who's pregnant and sad for yourself, and they're both right. And so it can be complicated and messy, and that's okay.
Yeah, we as humans are pretty complicated and pretty mm-hmm. messy, and you know, mm-hmm. I think we're geared for it. So, I think we will be okay. Well, thank you so much, Andrea Sertesh. For everyone who I know now wants to find out more about Pregnantish, you can go to their website, pregnantish.com. You can get more information about Andrea. Andrea, what is your personal website? I think it's Andrea Sertesh.
That's right. I have a funny name. AndreaSertesh.com. You can also find me, Cheat on Your Husband with Your Husband is an easier book title to remember than my last name.
Yeah, there you go. So you can just Google that as well, and you will
see my name.
Let me remind everyone that the views expressed in this show are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the position of Creating a Family, our partners, or our underwriters. Also, keep in mind that the information given in this interview is general advice. To understand how it applies to your specific situation, you need to work with your infertility professional. Thank you, everyone, and we will see you next week.